She's dead.
Death, a funny business on FUBAR Radio with Becky Briggs and Natasha Spencer-Levy.
It's all shits and giggles till somebody dies.
Mm-hmm. Becky's not here. Becky Briggs is not here. It's Matt Phipps again. God damn it.
It's me. You give me an opportunity to talk into a microphone. I will take you up on that offer every damn time.
Every single time. He's back in the studio, everybody. He's excited. I know I am.
I am. Friend of the pod.
Friend of the pod. How you doing, Matt?
Yeah, good, thanks. Good. Yeah. How about you?
Yeah.
You
all right? Fine.
Well, good. I'm glad we've covered that.
Anyway, shall we go?
What's been going on in your life?
Well, drama. There I am, sitting in my kitchen yesterday, my housemate's in the shower. All of a sudden I hear a trickle of water, and then Niagara Falls erupts from my kitchen ceiling lights.
Oh no, that's dangerous.
Oh god, do you want to know? It's honestly my worst nightmare. It's my worst nightmare. Like, genuinely, I've had dreams about that scenario happening, where it's like the kitchen just suddenly floods and then all of a sudden I'm covered in water. It's
two things. One, hope you're okay and with the lights on. Because that
the
could be dangerous.
The lights weren't on, so
oh,
thank
good,
God.
Thank God. Two, dream bigger.
Thank you, Matt.
You're welcome. That's very dangerous. Very scary. Yeah, is someone going to come around and fix that?
Yeah, we have a lovely plumber at 64. Not going to tell you where I live, but
no,
he,
don't give
but,
your address,
but he
no.
lives. He lives down the road, so he's going to come and fix my plumbing. Couldn't get away with it. It's too late. Anyway, so today we have a really nice show. Welcome to Death of Funny Business, by the way. It's 5 o'clock on a Tuesday. And we have two very exciting guests today. We have Neil Labute, who is a renowned playwright and the writer of a new play, How to Fight Loneliness, which we are going to go see soon, which is quite exciting. And Matt might come with us, me and Becky. Who knows? Little Death of Funny Business outing.
The invite's been extended.
I think you should come.
24 hours to RSVP, I think.
Okay, well, you know, look in your diary, popular person.
Oh, very busy.
And then we have Carla Fernandez, who is the co-founder of The Dinner Party, a platform for grieving 21 to 45-year-olds to find a community. And, yeah, it's going to be a lovely show.
Yeah, amazing guests. Really looking forward to it.
Yeah.
Both really interesting.
Mm-hmm. Well, what about you? Do you have any interesting pieces of drama for me?
No drama. I'm a dramaless man.
I haven't got
any drama, so that's a bit boring. But I have started my own podcast, which I will, of course, be plugging
right now.
Oh, my
gosh. Tell us all about your new podcast.
Who'd have thought I'd be plugging it so soon? But here we are.
He got a taste of what it was like on Death Funny Business, and now he's like, I need to do this. It feels important to me.
I got a taste of the good life.
Yeah,
I want more. I started one with my sister. It's only recording me and her chatting on the sofa. We basically just review the week of social media content. The main portion is called Another Day in the Content Mines, where we just mine some of the cultural debris away and
I love it.
And chat through some of the awful things that have been going on.
Oh yeah, 100%. I mean, it's always fun having the Met Gala while the world is burning.
Yeah, oh,
that
it's
makes
very
me feel really great.
Very strange.
It feels like the Hunger Games. I'm also reading the new Hunger Games book, and I was actually reading it and I was like, oh, this is so weird. We're watching the, like, I was looking at all the Met Gala content this morning, and I was literally like, this is fucking crazy. The world is literally at war and burning. I also watched The Darkest Hour. Darkest Hour?
Churchill
movie.
Yeah, yeah.
Last night, because I think it was VE Day. It was VE Day. It was on the telly, so I was watching it. And I was like, girl, why? I was literally in my brain, I was like, this is kind of embarrassing that you think you have problems. People went to war. People are having war right now. Like, grow the fuck up. Your mum died. Move on.
It is quite scary,
like,
and disturbing. But also, I do really enjoy looking at their outfits. You know, some of them, the people who you can tell maybe are quite nice people.
Yeah,
which is very few of them. But there were some very cool outfits, and I also actually maybe more so enjoy when the outfits are awful.
Oh god,
terrible.
Some of them are really bad.
Really, really bad.
Really
bad. But and they're bad because they've tried.
Yeah,
you know, they've tried. And
do you think?
Flopped.
Do you think that the Met Gala would have encouraged you to wear a skirt? We were talking about this earlier. Matt doesn't like wearing shorts.
Yeah, I hate wearing shorts.
And so I suggested you should wear a skirt. Do you think? You think you'd be inspired by any of the Met Gala looks this year?
I'd love to wear a skirt. I'd love to wear all these different
things. I think we're going to make it happen.
But then walking out of your house in South London in just like a random place, you can't be wearing the really cool things that you want to wear in your dreams, because
in your dreams,
because everyone else is just wearing. Clearly, I care too much about what other people
maybe
think,
well,
it would just be, it would be too
eye-catching. Who was your favorite Met Gala look? Do you have one this year?
Oh my god, there were so many.
So many.
Just
been dreaming.
No, I can't think of any. I can't
Do you
think
know
of
what?
Any names.
I will say, I think they missed the assignment this year, like. They didn't quite get it right. Like, it was like dandyism and like freaking tailoring and like a male owned black kind of style fashion, and it just kind of fell a bit flat. I was a bit like, guys, you know who did Slay? What's her name? Janelle Monáe. She was so great.
What,
beautiful red jacket.
What does she do?
Stunning red jacket, and then on top of like beautiful suit. Anyway, I don't know why we're talking about this. Fantastic feathered hat. But yeah, very Hunger Games-esque.
Yeah.
Not sure how I feel about it.
No, they should have also invited Wisdom K, the famous TikToker, because he is the epitome of the theme, and also he's fucking awesome.
Yeah.
And has a much better fashion sense than all of them lot, so.
Pretty much. Well, and again, the world is dying. Burning? Dying.
Both.
Both. A little bit of both.
Wow, what a segue.
This is going so well. But yeah, no, I'm a bit pissed about the weather, I'll tell you that.
Yeah,
I think it was just a little bit teasing, really. Mother Nature just teased me.
Yeah,
she was like, she was like, you know, it's going to be really warm. You get to wear a dress. I can't believe you just said that on live radio. Actually,
is that no? You said it was allowed to swear.
No,
and
you
say
can do whatever
like
you want. Yeah, it took me a second. I was like, wow, he just said that.
It's just interesting.
God.
You're not thinking about your personal brand very much.
No, I'm not really. Am I?
No, me.
Oh, you.
Wow. Yeah, but it'll come back. I'm just hoping it doesn't come back over Glastonbury in full force. It can't be raining loads.
No.
And it can't be like 35, 40 degrees. Well, 40 degrees is ridiculous, but.
No.
Yeah, I just want it to be nice and 24 degrees.
I like a good 22.
Get my skirt out. You're a 22 girl.
I'm a 22
no?
girl. 22. Yeah. Get copyrighted for that. Fuck's sake.
I'm going to wear a skirt at Glastonbury. I've decided.
This is what I'm saying.
Yeah, I'm doing it because that's
this
a place that you can. That's a good trial
that's
ground.
That's a perfect
right?
Trial ground. I'm seeing like a nice little half pleated kilt thing with a nice little leather buckle on you know, and then a little long, maybe a longer bit, or like you can have like a denim section and then like it wraps round.
There's a lot of sections going. I'm struggling to visualize
this. Little pocket, tiny little pocket, maybe some utility.
Well, yeah, I need to put for my things.
Yeah, for all your things.
Yeah.
Well, no, or you could experience what it's like to be a woman and have no pockets, and then you'll really understand pain.
Well, I've always one other thing that I've really wanted to be sporting recently is a handbag, and there's a rising popularity of male leather handbags.
Get a male leather handbag. I think you should.
I want to, because the backpack I've brought in today is ugly. You looked at it when I walked in, and you were like, "What the hell's that? That's the worst thing I've ever seen."
I can't believe you saw right through me. I was like, "Is he okay?
No,
where are you going?"
I'm not.
No, it's not a nasty backpack. It's just a backpack. I like an Osprey backpack.
So you did notice it. You noticed that I was only joking. You noticed the
Matt,
exact
I notice
brand.
Everything you do. I'm very aware. I'm like
fan,
thinking about,
fan.
Oh, yeah, big fan. Thinking about skirts, thinking about buckles. Okay. Anyway, I don't think your backpack's ugly.
Okay, thanks.
I just wanted to let you know.
That's great, because it's actually part of a two-part backpack.
Oh,
that's
good.
The small one. There's a much, much bigger one, 55 litres.
Damn.
And it's hot. It's got the straps over there, but it's also got the straps around the stomach.
Do you
want to
know something crazy?
You in.
Do you want something crazy? I have the same backpack.
I really thought you were going to say I don't
turquoise.
Care.
If I'd said I don't care, that would have been a lot funnier. But I'm a fucking nerd, so apparently I was just going to be like, yeah, we're the same. I have a big backpack too.
Same backpack in grey. What for?
No, in turquoise.
In turquoise.
Yeah, because I travel.
For backpacking and things as well.
Went to Cambodia.
Oh, yeah.
Trekked around for a bit. Had a great time.
Find yourself.
Fell in love. That was nice. That's a story for another day.
With whom?
With my ex-boyfriend, my first boyfriend.
Okay.
We were babies. Yeah. It was actually lovely. He nearly died. And then he was like, I love you. And I was like, it's okay. Oh, I love you too.
It's like in the movies.
It was like in the movies. My whole life is a movie. Genuinely, it's a stupid, stupid series of strange events.
Your life is a series of unfortunate
events.
I was
talking about this the other day with my friends. My friend said to me, you're very main character. And I was like, oh, I don't know if I appreciate that. That kind of feels like a bit of a...
Sounds like an insult.
It sounds like an insult. And then I was like, well, actually, now I think about it, I am half an orphan. So, okay. Batman, Harry Potter, Anne of Green Gables.
Yeah.
I'm just saying.
I'm seeing it.
Main character? Anyway.
I can see it.
I was like, yeah, firm. And then, like, weird universe-y shit happens to me all the time. Mm. Like, creepy little coincidences. Like, the universe is just like, ha ha, be a witch, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. It does do that. The universe is relentless.
Oh, yeah.
And those things often come in, what do they say, threes?
Threes.
Yeah. So you probably do a few more.
Fuck.
Yeah.
I've had more than three. Maybe it's three.
If you've had more than three, then you do another three. Two, then maybe, multiples of three.
Multiples of three.
Yeah. Well, I hope you're okay.
I don't think I'm ever okay.
And how's your grief?
How's my grief? Yeah. Good question. It is a show about grief.
Yeah, I'm with you.
How's my grief? Do you know what? Not great. I'll be honest. Oh. Yeah, I've been really missing Mum recently. I feel like I'm 25, I'm in the big city, I'm single, and I'm kind of not knowing what's going on. And it's that horrible sticky period where you're in, like, and you're just a bit stuck. And the only thing you want is your parents. And my mum is not here, so that sucks. How's your grief?
I'm sorry to hear that.
No, that's all right.
25 as well. Ugh. God, that's the worst. For me, that was not a good time.
It's not a good time to be alive.
Not good.
No.
Not good. But it is, because it's all part of the journey.
Exactly.
The uncomfortableness means that you're figuring stuff
that's
out.
That's what I keep
whether,
telling
whether
myself.
You know it or not,
exactly.
It might not feel like it, but you will.
Mm-hmm.
You'll get there.
Thank
wherever,
you, man.
Whatever there is.
Amen.
It will present itself.
It will.
And you got friends, and you got loads of people around you. Yeah, well,
she's got friends.
Well, so you keep saying, keep assuring me you have friends.
Shut the fuck up! Don't tell me. Don't tell people I'm saying that I have friends. I didn't say that, guys. Guys, I swear I didn't say that I had friends. I don't have friends.
My grief is okay.
So, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It doesn't come up in. I busy myself a lot, so it doesn't come up in my head that much. So. I imagine when it does, eventually, that'll result
in
it.
You feel like you're due a big cry, maybe?
A great big shower cry.
Ooh, yeah.
Great big cry on the floor, crumbled up in a heap.
Ooh, hot. Yeah.
Listening to some sad music. Oh, it's not going to be hot.
Do you know what that sounds? That sounds like fun.
Yeah.
Sounds like fun.
I think it feels really... Is it the word?
Cathartic.
That was the word I was going to say, yeah. It is. It is cathartic.
No, it is. It's very important. And, I mean, we talked about this the other day on our page, but... crying is like with Mary Frances O'Connor, who was the psychologist who came on the show quite a while ago, and she was talking about how crying physically releases a lot of emotions and
you can,
I mean, obviously
that makes sense, doesn't it? You can feel it.
Scientifically,
feel
as well.
So much lighter afterwards.
You can actually breathe.
Yeah,
it's like, oh god, I've been storing all of that for so long. It's like a good poo.
It is. It's like a great big, lovely heap of poo.
Yeah.
And,
amen.
Yeah. Wow. That's really thrown me back, actually.
So we're going to go to a break.
I think I need one.
Have the best time, guys, listening to these ads. And we're going to be out of here in a bit.
Foobar Radio.
What the hell with Georges Bertineau on Foobar Radio.
I'm joined by Alex Mitten, retreat host and mentor.
I think a lot of people are lonely, surrounded by people at the minute. Like, you know, especially living in London, there's fucking people everywhere. But
yeah.
We sort of live these quite strange lives now where we're quite closed down emotionally, you know, even just like with our voice. We don't really speak that often sometimes, do you know what I mean?
Download our app now to listen to your favourite shows, such as Access All Areas, Politics Uncensored, and The Dating Show. You can also download and catch up on previous episodes of all FUBAR shows, including our box sets. Plus, you can get in touch directly from within the app.
Just search for FUBAR Radio on the Apple and Google App Stores.
Yay! The FUBAR Radio app. Get it today.
Get it today.
It was calm on the beach. So I took my little girl out on the water. Then we hit the wind. And it blew us out to sea. Faster than we could paddle back. And we learned our lesson. From these guys. The crew who got us home. Thank you.
Respect the water and watch out for the winds. In an emergency, call 999 and ask for the Coast Guard.
If you drink a little, then drive. You risk losing your license. You risk every day becoming more complicated.
How am I supposed to get to training, Dad? How am I supposed to...
You risk losing your job.
I'm going to have to let you go.
You risk your family not looking at you the same way.
I can't believe you did that.
You risk injuring someone.
Hello, I need an ambulance.
You risk being seen as a drink driver. Drink a little, risk a lot. Think.
Couple Goals with Sophie Kasai and Jordan Brooke.
When is too early to say I love you? So I've said it the night we met.
Yeah. I did. Right, okay, right. Let's just clear this up, right? When I said I love you, I remember I said it in the car.
In the cab, yeah.
In the cab. And I was like, oh my God, I love you.
Yeah, well, that was the day I made you my girlfriend, wasn't it?
Yeah. And I said, I love you. And you were like, I love you too. And I was like, I love you, 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 I love you so much, I love you so much. Oh my God, I love you.
Access all areas with Bobby Norris.
We are joined by Miss Safia. If I could produce you a salt, what is he like on paper? Sound like we're on Love Island.
Okay, on paper, my type has to have a good soul, yeah. Good purpose and calm energy. I'm in my energy era where you've just got to come in and make me happy. I don't need you for anything. I wanna find happiness and I need him to be kind.
Death, a funny business on FUBAR Radio with Becky Briggs and Natasha Spencer-Levy.
And we are back. And we have Neil LaBute in the, well, on Zoom with us today. Hi, Neil. Can you hear us?
Hi, Neil.
I can, very well.
Hi, how are you doing today?
Thanks. How are you guys?
Yeah, very good. Excited to talk to you. So I guess we'll just jump straight in and we'd love to hear a bit about your new play. And I'd just like to say I'm a big fan of your work. And obviously when we got the sheet through, I was like, oh, I know this fella. So it's really cool to have you on. And if you would like to tell us about How to Fight Loneliness and all about your new play.
Absolutely. I'll tell you whatever you like. It's a play that originated at a Shakespeare festival in Utah. I actually written it before, but a former professor of mine was working there developing new work along with all of the classics that they were doing. And I thought it was kind of a perfect show to develop and get a chance to work with him again. And I was tackling this idea of assisted dying, you know, that I had dealt with my mother's passing very recently at that point and found it to be a very difficult thing to go through as people do. Mm. I wasn't around for my father's death. He passed very quickly. But I spent time with my mom in the hospital and it was a rough go. And so it led me to, I'm not really that writer or that person that is a, you know, autobiographical or biographical writer, but sometimes something obviously will spark you. And this certainly helped me push me along toward that idea of people who have this goal, have a desire. In this case, a woman who's dealing with cancer and it's come back and feels that she's at the point that she can't live with it any longer, but also can't, find the place in herself to do something about it on her own and has spoken to her husband about it. He wants her to live obviously as long as possible. They don't live in a kind of right to die state where there's help through the system. And so they turn to a former, not even really friend, but a former, student at the same high school that she went to. And because of his past, which we find out about along the way, they ask him, is it something that he might be willing to do and help them? Mm. And so it deals a lot with obviously the journey toward death, the pain level that people can deal with in their lives, the choices they make, who has the agency to tell you what right you have about even your own death, you know, those kinds of things without being hopefully not a big issue play and still a relationship play between three people who are trying to point out, you know, how much they care about each other.
For sure. And I'm really sorry to hear about your mom's passing. And
thank you.
I hope that you don't mind me asking, but we often ask people if they feel comfortable to tell us a bit about the person that they've lost on this show, because at Death a Funny Business, we're all about keeping people's memories alive and stuff. So if you'd like to talk about your mum a little bit, you could tell us a little bit about her, maybe her name.
It won't fit greatly into the title, obviously. It wasn't too hilarious.
No. I'm sure it wasn't hilarious.
Yeah. Although some probably are. There's along the way that someone might actually tell a story with it, you know, with a smile and a giggle at some point. That wasn't the case here. That mom, I was working on a television show and not geographically too far away, quick enough that I could jump on a plane and get to where she was and be with her. And she was in the hospital. She did not have great health her entire life, really. I would say she dealt with scarlet fever when she was young. She spent, at least the lore of it is she spent like an entire calendar year in bed as a young,
as a young kid.
And so she was not fragile, but she was not always in the best of health. And she had back issues and lots of things that, you know, and so she was into her 80s and really went into the hospital. We thought maybe just she had a couple of times before, but as it became more and more evident that it was perhaps getting close to the end, my brother, I have an older brother, and it's the only sibling I have, and he had really throughout our lives kind of as just because being an older brother, I guess, and kind of taken that lead and had jumped in often in terms of our parents and health and that kind of thing, had been the one who would often make those trips and make decisions. And I would hear things and go along or have a thought about them. But he often took the lead. But in this case, he really asked me to do that. And, and it put me in a position where I, you know, my eyes were opened in a certain way by being in the hospital with her and sitting with her and just seeing her every day and going through the pains that she was going through, and her really, you know, never asking for an assistance in death or anything per se, but so much by just, you know, really asking for me to help her, you know, just help me. And that translated a lot into the play, the idea of like, is helping someone through that experience, you know, hurting them or helping them, or you know, do we consider that killing someone, or is that helping someone, and those kinds of things again come up in the play. But at the time, it was I found the hospital to be lacking in some ways, that the general sense of empathy or sympathy, or which, you know, depending on who you were. That she was, you know, not the easiest of patients at that time, and was loud and just in excruciating pain from her point of view, and that got to be to a place where they were asking us to leave. Really, they were trying to off on a you know, a hostel, not a hostel. What am I trying to say?
A hospice.
A hostel. That would be amazing. Can you go to the youth hostel? No, a hospice. And I remember the hospice worker coming in and being, you know, I really don't think she's going to be a great fit for this and everything. And within a half an hour of sitting with me and her, she was like, yeah, I think she's going to be perfect for us. And I don't know if it was talking to the people at the hospital or not, or just her turnaround in that short amount of time. But I think she went to a hospice perhaps sooner than she needed to. And she didn't have the Jimmy Carter experience of, you know, going on for a year or more or something like that. It was relatively quick after she went to a hospice, because of the nature of the kind of care that they provide. But it felt like I was being, you know, very, very, not even gently pushed in that direction. When I wish I'd had more time to make a decision or to help in any other way. So it was a very, very fraught time. And I then left to go back and work on the show that I was the one sort of running the place. And I said, just try and let me know if there's anything, there's a turn or anything. And I heard sort of too late. I got a chance to jump on a plane again, but I had a stopover. And when I landed and turned on my phone, I'd heard that she'd passed away. And so I always felt, you know, those things that one goes through, remiss or I should have stayed longer or, you know, so I had the full complement of bad in that experience. It just, it never felt great. And, you know, years later, you kind of still feel all that. And again, not all of that went into the play, but just the experience was different than sometimes where I'm just making up stuff completely from research or from what I think a person's experience might be in a situation. I certainly had a lot to choose from in this case.
Absolutely. Did you find that you got, obviously you said that you had a bit of a different experience writing this play with a bit more of a personal experience. Did you find catharsis from the writing, or did you find that it was trickier? Obviously, assisted dying, there's a lot of ethical questions behind it, and there's a lot of, you know, rhetoric going on publicly about it. Was that tricky alongside your own personal experience?
I suppose a bit. But once you've created a group of people and their experience is quite different, you really are trying to see those people through. This will never be universal to people. I think, you know, they look at this and say, could this possibly happen to those three people in the play? And does that feel right for their experience as an audience? You know, not seeing through it. And even though I think in the program they put in a piece that I wrote for not to accompany the show, but for another outlet that had asked me to write about the play. And so there's some sense that, oh, this is coming from something in his life. The differences are so great that it's, I wouldn't say no. I walked away feeling like, well, that took away some of the anguish. You know, you it's still a personal thing that you kind of have to live with the rest of your life, and you know, hold that up to all the good things and the time that was good, even that you spent in the hospital, say, with her. You know, I went and I ran to the bookstore and bought a book that I knew she loved and read from that to her, and so all of that was a positive thing, but. You know, there was certainly enough on the downside that made it a really difficult. And I didn't have my brother there during that time, and so he had his own set of challenges and pains to go through that he, you know, missed out on that. And so it was a very particular experience, just like it would be for anyone. And but, you know, what it did of course give me, because up until that point I hadn't had to go through a lot of funerals or deaths of friends or family. And so gave me certainly fresh perspective and a greater sense of, you know, emotion, thinking about what other people go through. And it's easy sometimes to forget those things or have a general response to that. Oh, isn't that terrible or whatever it is. It sort of, you know, will always spark now when someone says something about, oh, my father passed away. It's like, very easy for me to go and commiserate in a very connected and more personal way than just a general, I'm sorry for your loss.
Mm. That's really interesting. Thank you for sharing. I had a question. What are some of the key emotions that you're hoping that the audience will leave feeling? And are they the same as the ones that you found yourself feeling as the writer of this?
That's a good question. No, I don't think they are, because that experience, as I mentioned, was very much centered around last days in the hospital and that kind of thing, as opposed to the play breaks into three scenes. One is where this gentleman from her past, from Jody's past, comes into the house and they discuss this in a very, you know, roundabout way, what they're, or really what she is hoping might come from this. And so it's kind of removed from I tried not to make a play that was filled with hospital jargon and,
for sure,
and, you know, statistics and things like that. You can find those plays. People love to do research and say, did you know there's this much of that in the world, and how many percentages of people have done this? And this is much more about people who haven't had to deal with this until it's dropped into their lap, and they don't want to, and certainly don't want to do it again. They have already done it. So emotionally, it's really, you know, three sides of a coin of someone who's dealing with something and saying, you can't know what this feels like until you go through it. And to hear you, even as my husband, say, we're doing this and we're doing that. And at one point, Jody really kind of puts her foot down and is like, this is me. This isn't you. You're here, but it's me. And you can't say that you know what I'm going through. Even you can't say that. I mean, you could say it, but you're wrong. It's like, I am going through something that nobody else can feel. And if you've broken your leg in the past or been in a car accident and it hurt, I believe you. But you still have no idea what it's like to deal with the pain that comes with this particular disease. And that I've had enough and I'm ready to go. And I don't want to move to Oregon. And at the core of it also, by the end of the third scene, we find that there's other information. I've been one of those people who've had a, you know, sting in the tail of a few of my works, but this isn't necessarily that, but there is information that her husband and the gentleman in question who's helping them aren't privy to until toward the end. And realize why, in fact, she's in as much of a hurry as she is to be done with her life. And so that's an issue that comes up people will hopefully, you know, at intermission or on their way home, they'll talk about and say, this is how I feel about that. What do you think she should have done or I would have done? Or, oh, that's great. If people think about what you've done for 10 minutes afterwards in this day and age, you know, most people are running home and doing 1,000 things and got to get back to Netflix. And so God bless if people, you know, continue to think about it beyond the time they spend in a theater. But I hope that's the case. But emotionally, as you asked, I think just the subject opens up enough of a well for people that everybody has a different take on what I would do or, you know, what I will do, or I've written down that I want people to do for me, or all those things that, I don't want people to say necessarily question their own choices, but it's always great if they think about something and thought, oh, I hadn't actually considered that. Mm-hmm. I never imagined myself being put in that situation. And as, you know, fellow creatures, we know that, you know, we are all generally capable of the great highs and lows that any person can go through. We want to think that everybody's so different and it's us and them. But in the end, we kind of prove over and over every day how much similar we are than different than everyone around the globe. And in these big questions like that, we face them in very, very similar ways a lot of the time. So it's, for me, it'd be great if people, you know, see something that reinforces what they believe or opens a new door or window for them. That would be fantastic as well. But I still, in the end, want them to spend 2 hours and go, that was a good piece of theater.
Yeah.
You know, that in the end, I didn't write a book about death and dying. I wrote a play about three people who are going through a dramatic event. And that's at the close or, you know, I don't think there is a curtain, frankly, but the lights go down. You want people to have made that pact with you, and that conceit has been paid of you gave your money and time and I gave you a good show. And even though we've all thought about death in certain ways and seen, you know, marriage plays and you know, a stranger comes into the midst of all that, I still have to give you a show that hopefully you go, oh, that was an interesting take on that. I haven't seen that one before.
And I wonder, finally, just we were talking a bit earlier about how in Britain our culture of death and dying is quite severe and cold. I wonder if you found there's a difference between the response you've had in the States, and you said it started in Utah, and the response you've had at the park. Has there been a difference in that way?
I suppose there always is some difference. You know, I found now at this point in my career that how similar audience reactions can be. While you might have, you know, curtain calls that are as long as the play itself in Germany or Russia, you know, they run out on stage. They just don't stop. They're like, they never stop them. But the actual experience of an audience is quite similar. And when you see them connecting with the play and their heads not looking at their watch or the program or each other, you know, you've connected with them in some way. And mm-hmm. and that experience is happily quite the same around the world. Yes, people face these things differently. But I think that in the dark, you know, people open themselves up a little bit. Mm. And while they might even talk about something differently at a dinner or, you know, among friends and at home, to be in the quiet and the dark and listening to something.
Yes.
I think people do allow things in a, you know, a more personal way. And so I would say that audiences have, you know, reacted in, because there's a large event in the middle of the play that people have, you know, either accepted or questioned, like as the mode to which death comes, you know, which I don't really want to, you know, say specifically. People either see it or they don't, but that can sometimes bring up questions for people. Say, oh my gosh, would you really make that as your choice? For me, it just has to be within the realm of possibility. You know, I'm not saying this is what everyone would do. This is what three people choose to do, you know? And so that, I think, gets questioned in a certain way, either by critics or by an audience. And they go, yeah, I it's crazy in a way, but I get it. Or that's highly unusual. And it throws me out of the play. I'd rather take a risk like that, absolutely, you know, and have an audience go, that's, you know, compelling for the right reasons rather than the wrong reasons. It's better to take a swing and do something interesting again that you haven't seen. But overall, no, generally I feel like audiences are, you know, I mean, look, UK audiences are among the best I've ever been around because they grow up in a culture of theater in a way that Americans just don't. You know, I didn't at all. I grew up in a very rural, blue collar, you know, I went to the movies all the time. I watched TV, but the theater was not readily accessible. I loved it from the minute I saw it, but you know, it wasn't a part of my daily life. And you go to London, you go to New York, you have people who go to the theater regularly and they understand the draw of that thing, that live connection with a set of actors that is unlike any other kind of artistic experience that they have, you know, other than the other, you know, performing arts like dance and that kind of thing. So it's, UK audiences are, you can't beat them in terms of their ability to connect to theater.
Oh, amazing.
But yeah, sometimes seeing, you know, American play or a play from France that's been translated, they're going to have a different, you know, experience or reaction based on their own upbringing. But it's a lot of the same. And that's a good thing that people, you know, when given a good play, they're willing to be transported to someplace and go for 2 hours and see an interesting show and say that's beyond my experience and I appreciate that.
Amazing. Thank you so much, Neil. I cannot personally wait to go and see the show. So, the show is on at the Park Theatre until the 24th of May and, best of luck with the run.
Thank you, guys. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much. Thanks. Have the best day.
All right. Take care.
And we'll be going to a break.
FUPAR Radio. Politics Uncensored.
The more alarming question is, what does this say to victims of these sorts of crimes which have been alleged on them? Essentially, what they'll be looking at is two men who have a huge online influence, who say some of the most disgusting things online and spout off some of the, I think, most dangerous sort of ideas and narratives in the online space, that they've essentially been able to travel to the US while they're still under investigation in multiple countries.
You're listening to FUBAR Radio.
Download our app now to listen to your favourite shows, such as Access All Areas, Politics Uncensored, and The Dating Show. You can also download and catch up on previous episodes of all FUBAR shows, including our box sets. Plus, you can get in touch directly from within the app.
Just search for FUBAR Radio on the Apple and Google App Stores.
The FUBAR Radio app. Get it today.
Get it today.
Registering to vote means you can take part in the way decisions are made in the UK. When you register to vote, you are then able to cast your vote at local and national elections. You can help choose who runs your area and makes decisions about things you care about. Millions of people in the UK aren't registered to vote, and they miss out on having their voice heard. It's quick and easy to register. It only takes 5 minutes. You can do it online, or you can ask for a paper form at your local council. Register to vote now at gov.uk/registertovote.
I was fine on this beach the other day. I didn't know the time of high tide changes, and I had no idea it could come in so fast. So I'm finding out the hard way. From this fella, the Coast Guard, who dropped in to get me out.
Ready!
Before you go to the coast, check the tide times online. In an emergency, call 999 and ask for the Coast Guard.
Pulse of the Nation with Andrew White on FUBAR Radio.
Are you aware of the tea alarm?
Tell me more.
Yeah. Yeah, so it's this cultural phenomenon that we have in Britain. It's an alarm at 3 p.m. Where everybody in the UK has to have a cup of tea, and if you miss it by a certain number of minutes, you get fined, basically.
This ain't real. This is not real. I'm not playing into this.
Yeah.
You think me watching Keeping Up Appearances, you think Mrs. Bouquet was missing a 3 o'clock tea alarm? Y'all won't get me.
Couple Goals with Sophie Kasai and Jordan Brooke.
When I've met people in the past, I'm like, oh yeah, I really love him, he's the one. But I just knew they weren't. I'd say it, but I knew I didn't mean it. But when I met you, there was a different feeling. Like, it's like your gut just tells you. When people used to say, when you know, I was like, oh, piss off. But when you know, you know.
When I met you and times got hard, I would come up with a strategy to make it better.
Death, a funny business on FUBAR Radio with Becky Briggs and Natasha Spencer-Levy.
And we are back. And on Zoom, I keep saying in the studio, on Zoom, we have Carla Fernandez, who is the co-founder of The Dinner Party, a platform for grieving 21 to 45-year-olds to find community, peer-led support, and build lasting relationships. Hello, Carla. How are you doing?
Hi. Beautifully read.
Oh,
beautifully
read. Thank you so much. Thank you. I try. Where do we find you today?
I live in New York. I live outside of the city, in the woods.
And in the woods.
Yeah.
We were just saying how beautiful we think your room is.
We were admiring your room. It looks like what did you say it was called? An eave?
In the eaves. Are you in the eaves of a roof?
I am. In a cabin.
In the cabin.
A log cabin in the woods.
Oh,
lovely.
We were sitting on this couch having tea. What's
it's a lovely colour sofa as well.
It's lovely.
A huge fan
it's
of a
kind
green
of like baby
sofa.
Diarrhea, but it's a favorite colour.
Oh, wow. That is an image. So tell us a bit about The Dinner Party, how it kind of came about and what it's all about. Tell us everything.
I'll do my best. I was a 21-year-old when my dad died of cancer and was sort of found myself looking for support and resources.
Absolutely.
Went to, as one does.
As one does.
After one has been like drop kicked into the existential question that is, what do you do when someone you care about dies way sooner than you thought that they might?
Mm-hmm.
And I had this sort of Goldilocks experience of going to therapy, loving my therapist, would take a month for my therapist, but like a 45-minute conversation, I couldn't really text her in the in-betweens. We're not friends.
Yeah, for sure.
Went to grief support groups, but oftentimes I was the youngest one in the room for the parent loss group where folks were losing parents at maybe a more quote-unquote natural age, like in their 50s or 60s, which kind of left me feeling even more isolated. And I found that what I really wanted to do was hang out, open up a bottle of wine, eat some good food, and talk as you would with friends with like an elastic back end, not just about the grief or the death or the diagnosis, but about how we were navigating life after and what do you do when you're dating and someone asks you a question related to your grief or how do you deal with dynamics with the living, etc. So I gathered a group of other young people that I knew who'd experienced a significant loss and invited them over to this like weird blind date freak social experiment of what might happen if we hang out and take the topic we've all gotten very good at avoiding and like literally make it the main dish of the evening. And it was a beautiful, best blind date ever. We ended up staying up late that night, had so much to talk about, things to cry about together, but also piss our pants laughing about, and before we knew it, there was this like sense that we were on to something, and that original table started meeting monthly. And then people started to hear about it, wanted to come, but we were like, you can't sit with us, you have to start your own table. And my co-founder and friend, Lennon Flowers, who was at that first dinner, decided to quit her day job. And together we built the dinner party to it is today. It is just in the U.S., but we have about 20,000 folks across the U.S. that gather regularly for these dinners, both in person and virtual.
Wow, that is so cool. 20,000 people coming for dinner.
Coming for dinner.
How fun.
That's so cool. And I absolutely love the phrase you used there, navigating navigating the dynamics of the living.
Me and Matt we looked at each other and I was like, did you catch that?
It's the hardest thing of all.
Navigating the living.
That's such a lovely concept and one that I would have loved. I think that sounds fun and useful and helpful for those people as well.
Yeah, how do we navigate the living? That's such a good question. How did you navigate the living, Carla?
You know, there was something about having a group of friends with whom I could hang out with who were not my family members, who were not grieving the same person that I was grieving, where I could kind of unpack what was happening, get some perspective, not get advice from these folks, but just a listening ear that allowed me to vent, to clarify, and to figure out how I wanted to be supportive of the grievers that I loved, who are my siblings and other folks in my family, knowing that I had support from this dinner party table. I didn't have to rely on my family for all of the care that I needed. So it's a little bit of a pitch for our work in that, but there's something powerful about like finding your crew that you can
go for sure
with, who is not also grieving the same person that you lost.
Totally.
I don't want to jump straight into practicalities, but I do have quite a practical question as I'm thinking through how it could work in a scenario where I'm invited to one. Please invite
Let's get logistical.
How do you ensure that it remains open and welcoming to everyone while also protecting those in the group, if you see what I'm getting at? You know, because it's quite a divisive topic in general, and it can be very emotional for some people, and depending on what part of the journey they're at, that could bring in some energy that others might not be ready to deal with, you know?
So it's a good question. I like your sensitivity to the dynamics of the living.
Thank you. It was very well worded.
He likes to think about people, Matt. Yes. Yeah. Cares about the living.
So when someone signs up to host a table with us as a volunteer, they sort of write a little bit of a description around who they are and where they're at and what their relationship to their loss is. So you read the description, then you kind of raise your hand to join that table. So it's a little bit self-selecting.
Mm. Okay.
We also set some guidelines at the beginning of each dinner around the importance of using I statements, the importance of, you know, you don't have to share if you don't want to. And we've kind of crafted these rules of the road, so to speak, that don't feel overly formal, but yet help for some of those moments where the host might need to intervene or redirect the conversation and make sure folks feel safe and supported.
And you have a book coming out, don't you? Renegade Grief. I got it. Did you see me do it? I did it. And that's gonna be released on the 3rd of July. Could you tell us a bit about the book?
Sure. It is right here. Sneak peek.
It's beautiful.
We went Wild Ride.
Went Starscape.
I love it.
It's really beautiful.
So the book, Renegade Grief, is something that I've wanted to write for a long time. The title to me represents the ways in which to actually create the space in your life to tend to grief in what is, we often describe, at least in the US, as a grief-denying culture. You have to be like a little bit of a rebel. That actually taking care of your grief and being in conversation with it requires you to get a little radical.
Yeah.
Too often, I think grief is painted in these like really boring pastel tones. And it's like this like nice to have side issue. But to me, it is like one of the most powerful technicolor experiences that we go through as humans, whether we want to or not. And usually we don't.
For sure.
So that's kind of like the bigger idea of the book. And then within it are these stories of people who I have met who have, despite having little instruction around how to tend to grief, have found the care practices, the rituals, the creative experiments that have helped them answer this question, what do I do now? Like, how do I metabolize and move through my grief and not ignore it, sweep it under the rug, never talk about them ever again, and instead let the lessons from it inform the life that I want to live. So each chapter is an exploration of a different theme told with both anthropological, science, history, etc., but also fresh stories of people in our age range who are figuring it out, who I have been inspired by, and I know in retelling them, others will be inspired by them too.
That's awesome.
That's really amazing.
I feel like we're rebels too. Do you think that we're rebels? If we're not rebels,
you might be.
I think if we're talking about like wrapping grief up in a little, you know, pastel bow, I feel like Death of Funny Business doesn't do that. I feel like we also try and kind of be a bit more. So I Carla, I want to go for dinner, you know, like let's hang out.
Sounds like you're a renegade griever.
I feel quite connected to this label. I kind of want to take it up. But is there like a specific story that comes to mind that you might want to share, like a small thing that, or something that you'd quite like people to know about grieving, or something you'd like to leave our listeners with? Because we have a little bit of time left, actually. Sorry. We have like 3 minutes. So please tell us. Didn't say
anything. Just stream of consciousness for 3 minutes.
Just go. I didn't actually say a question, but
here's what I will leave you with. Within this book, Renegade Grief, there are these three big acts. I think it's helpful to think about tending to grief not as a cookie cutter single thing that we do, but rather ways in which we tend to renegade grief is about honoring our past, our relationship with that person, our relationship to who we were with that person. There's this whole act around being with your present. Like, how do you create spaces in which you can actually sit with grief in real time, in real ways, because we're so good at avoiding it or trying to run away from it.
For sure.
And the third act is all about creating your future and this idea of how might we take the brutally hard-earned lessons from grief and fold that into our future. And the sort of sneak peek of the book is that regardless of what part of that work we might be doing, the most important thing is to find our people and to be in relationship and companionship with folks who get it with us. Mm-hmm. So I'm a big proponent of peer support, and that's what the dinner party work is all about. And if anyone listening wants to sponsor the dinner party to come to the UK, we would just be so thrilled. We just need a donor to make it happen for us. So let's come find us at thedinnerparty.org.
We will. Oh my goodness. We should totally do that. Matt, any questions?
Hit you with a hard one.
Give her a hard one.
I don't know if I have any questions, just that I really appreciate the structure that you've just outlined. I think that when you've got things like the however many stages of grief that you hear about all the time,
yeah.
I think
it's like 10?
10, 8, whatever it is, you know, you can, they're very formulaic and they do end up putting you in a bit of a box sometimes, but especially if you're going through grief for the first time. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I found that anyway. And so what you've just detailed and outlined sounds like a much more, one, I was looking for something more practical at the time. It's like a process oriented, but not too, it's not going to confine you in a box where you're thinking, oh, I should be angry now, but I just feel sad. I think that sounds like a really, really well thought out practical structure you just said there. So I love that. Thank you for sharing. I don't think I have any hard hitting questions if we've only got 30 seconds left.
We have like 2 minutes left, but okay, I have one little question. Do you want to tell us a bit about your dad? Just something nice. His name?
I will. His name is Jose. Jose Fernandez.
Fantastic name.
He was the fifth, and what's fun is that my brother, who's also Jose, just had the. Did I say that my dad was the third, the fifth. The fifth just arrived recently. Because here, we're very excited about that. And he was great, and like a total weirdo, and a musician, and a hardworking wine business person, and
incredible.
Loved to play music on the piano. So those are a couple little factoids about him, and yeah, his. We spent a lot of time around the family dinner table, which was where the idea for me emerged. It was the place where I missed him the most. It was where my grief felt the most acute. So it made the most sense to go there to find the kind of quality of connection and conversation that I missed so much after he was gone. So,
And how do you carry on your the weirdo element?
By hosting dinner parties.
Of
course, and having baby sick colored sofas. for sure. Carla, thank you so much. Thank you so much for coming on, and we're going to wish you the best rest of your day.
Thank you.
I can't wait to host a dinner party. That's what me and Becky are going to do. And maybe Matt, if we let him. We might invite him. We're not sure.
I think let him.
We'll see. We'll see. Yeah, we'll all right. See. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Carla.
Well, Matthew, another show, another day. How do you feel? You've got 15 seconds. Tell me how you feel.
I feel really good, thanks. Feel really good. Yeah, another day, another dollar, another show.
Incredible.
Death, funny business, ha, ha, ha.
Yeah, thank you so much for co-hosting. I really appreciate it that you're here. Because
you're welcome.
It's harder to do it without another person.
Oh,
so,
of course, anytime. And I'm a professional dosser, so.
And we will see you next week. Bye-bye.
Foo Bar Radio.